This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about protesters' rights. I am joined by senior barrister and part-time judge Mr. Sailesh Mehta from Redline Chambers in London. Sailesh prosecutes and defends in high-profile, complex and law-defining cases, and he is described in the legal directories as a heavyweight and a charismatic advocate. He is a founding member of the Bar Human Rights Committee, and as its vice chairman, he has advised a number of organisations on human rights laws. Sailesh has lectured 250 judges from 45 countries, and he is also the joint author of a report on marching season in Northern Ireland, published by the Bar Human Rights Committee. Sailesh, it's ever so good to see you today. Thank you for joining me.
No, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
So protesters' rights. I know you and I have been speaking about this podcast for a while now, so I'm really pleased to be doing it. And I'm pleased that we're doing it as a bonus episode because it's such a topical issue, particularly with the Sarah Everard vigil that's going on, with the sentencing and courts bill that's just come out. So let's talk about it. I mean, protesting is legal in the UK, and the right to protest is protected under the European Convention of Human Rights. But there are restrictions and processes that protesters need to be aware of. It must be noted that this right is not absolute and can be limited in certain circumstances. And an example of this is when a protest or assembly would result in a threat to public health. Let's talk about protesting and demonstrations. What is the history of them, and where and how did they even start, Sailesh?
I suppose the history of demonstrations is the history of dissent. And if you put two human beings together for any significant period of time, there will be dissent.
That's like my household, actually. Sorry.
Under COVID rules, no doubt, there's been a lot of dissent. But of course, what we're talking about is a little more organised dissent. And so the history of demonstrations is the history of small groups or large groups of people saying, we will not put up with this, whatever this happens to be. In a democratic country, of course, it's a natural safety valve because we elect governments and they are elected for 4 years in this country, or 5 years in this country, 4 years in the United States. And in the interim, of course, that governments legislate. It's in the nature of governments to amass more and more power to themselves at the expense of ordinary people. And therefore, it is natural that there should be dissent, there should be protest. And the key question is, what is the relationship between the right to protest and, of course, the right of other people, ordinary individuals, to live their lives free of such demonstrations, and for the right of government to govern?
No,
so
indeed.
Those are the tensions that are at play in every demonstration, in every law that affects demonstrations.
No, indeed. I mean, it's quite interesting because, you know, if we try to look back at the history of demonstrations and when they started, I mean, I don't think there is any record really of the first demonstration that ever took place, ever.
I suppose the first peaceful demonstrations probably started in France. So there were, of course, very violent French revolutions, but probably in the late 17th, early 18th century. But the ones that were recorded, the first peaceful demonstrations recorded, were probably in this country, in London.
Wow.
And so the UK has a strong and rich history of peaceful demonstrations and protests, which then spread throughout the rest of the world.
So let's talk about examples of demonstrations and why they were, you know, why they're such an important part of our history.
Well, even as we speak, Hattie, there are demonstrations going on in London, where I am. The Extinction the demonstrations are taking place, that there are demonstrations going on in Bristol as we speak, in America, that the trial relating to the death of George Floyd is taking yes. place. There are constant vigils taking place. And so it is not a new topic. It is constant and is recurrent in this country as well as across the world. The Black Lives Matter protests took place in America and then spread all over the world, including in various cities in the UK. So that's the present. In the past, of course, demonstrations have often defined the history of not just a group of people, but sometimes nations. So to give you one example, the Salt March in India that took place when Mahatma Gandhi decided that the rule that stopped local people from using local salt without paying a huge tax, it was wrong. And so he decided to march, and he marched hundreds of miles, was joined by thousands and millions of demonstrators, and it brought about eventually, some say, the end of the British Raj. It awakened in the Indian people the thought that they could be the masters of their own destiny. So that's just one example of how one particular march was the catalyst for huge change.
Changes that have become history and that have affected the rest of our lives for so many people.
Absolutely. And when one can point to apartheid South Africa or segregationist America and similar huge nation-changing events and demonstrations that started with just one spark. So, for example, Rosa Parks, who was sitting on a bus and was told to move, to give up her seat for a white bus passenger, and she said no. And that was the start of the Montgomery protest.
No, indeed. I was only reading about that, actually, a few weeks ago. Yeah.
And so demonstrations can change local bylaws. So where I used to live in North London, there was a change to the local underground station. There were protests, and the aim was to change the local government, the council's view about the underground. So you can have very small demonstrations, small protests, all the way to national and international protests.
Indeed, indeed. And I mean, there's no age group, there's no definition of who can protest and who can't. I mean, I've certainly, when I've seen protests and marches, you see people of all walks of life, from all ages, all colours, all, you know, just tall, slim, female, old, young. And it's quite interesting because it is quite a unique way of people getting together. Often they seem like they're put together quite quickly when something has happened that, you know, has caused upset, outrage or disappointment. And it's a get together of just people from everywhere, from all walks of life, you know, coming together to prove a point and to have a bigger voice. But I mean,
of course, you remember from the Brexit, in the lead up to Brexit, there were marchers who were pro-Brexit and anti-Brexit, all marching at the same time. And the job of the police was to make sure that they were peaceful and that they were kept apart from each other. But you could have on the same day in the same city two opposing marches, all of whom have the right to hold the views that they want to express.
Indeed, indeed. And it's very interesting to even think about it like that. And of course, it did take place like that. But you kind of think, well, two opposing sides, a bit like the football match. I always worry at football matches, well, when we're not in the middle of a pandemic, because I think, how patient are the people that sit on that dividing line of one's for the team on the right, one's for the team on the left, but they're rubbing shoulders because they're on that dividing line of the football. You know, I know there's fences and things in between sometimes, but it is interesting that two opposite sides of an argument in terms of groups of people can march or protest at the same time, and it can remain, you know, calm and collective and peaceful. But what happens when demonstrations turn violent? I mean, examples of demonstrators being violent as well as the police being violent, what happens then?
The starting point is that demonstrations are not often violent. That's a good starting point. And of course, the next point one should bear in mind is always be slow to judgment about what's actually happened. So, of course, there will always be two sides of a story. One, the press particularly often get the police version of events earlier than the demonstrators' version of events. So in the Sarah Everard case, the media, in fact, were very quick to plaster across the world, in fact, pictures of police
Pulling demonstrators from left to right. Again. Yes, I mean that photo of that lady, and I don't know who that lady is. I still see it daily on an article somewhere.
But looking at equivalent demonstrations in Bristol, the police, I think, on the first day of what they termed the Bristol riots, gave out statistics to the press about the number of police officers that were hurt and injured. It now turns out that those figures and facts were wrong.
How bizarre.
The aim of that, cynic would say, was really to make sure that the public were on the side of the police. So the starting point is one needs to be careful about which news report one reads and from whose side it is written. But as I say, violence is rare from either the police side or from demonstrator side. But of course, it does sometimes happen, and sometimes it is on a tragic scale. I was simply going to say, in South Africa, for example, that the Soweto demonstrations, which started off as peaceful demonstrations against the apartheid regime, and the police fired live bullets. And many people, including children, were killed. And of course, that became international news and was one of the key events that led to the eventual dismantling of the apartheid regime.
Well, I mean, words of a wise man there about not judging straight up. I mean, I have to say, as a layperson, you get to see and hear of demonstrations once they're plastered all over the news. And I've always said it, I've said it for years, good news doesn't sell, really. Bad news, controversial news, shocking news sells. And they're the articles that people think, oh, goodness, what's happening there? What's going on there? And therefore, you know, you really, as a layperson, only hear, if you're not a part of the demonstration of the march, about them when they've gone wrong because they have turned violent. And it's very interesting, the point you make there about the Bristol riots, as you say, they've named them now, where the police gave figures in order to try and get the public on their side to support them in trying to keep it all peaceful. But, you know, I can understand how tensions can rally high very quickly. But, you know, I've never protested. I've never been part of a march or a protest myself. So I try to imagine if you're with a group of people and you've all saying the same thing, you're all there for the same reason, then what could spark that agitation? Because it's not as if you are, for example, I gave the football match example earlier, it's not as if you're hearing you know, the other side making comments that agitate you. You're with the people who are fighting the same cause as you. So what on earth can be agitating? Why would they turn violent, Salis, do you think? Why do they?
It depends on which side of the line you ask. So to go back to the Black Lives Matter demonstrations in America, not long after the George Floyd killings, of course, there were large demonstrations with hundreds of thousands of people, black and white, marching. But on the periphery, there was violence. There was looting, there was shops were petrol bombed, etc. And if you were on the police side of the march, then of course this was outrageous, as it always is. Any violence, it can't be justified in a demonstration like that. But from the protester side, the answer is, of course, these individuals were not part of the march. But if you bottle up emotions, if you bottle up for centuries, in the case of black Americans, the rights and freedoms in every aspect, from housing to employment to education, every now and then there are flashpoints, and youngsters in particular will react with anger, with anger comes violence. And of course, the responsible leaders of such demonstrations always condemn such violence, but they do try to explain that violence from that perspective, and one can understand, which is why, of course, a good government, a wise government, should always allow protests until they become violent. They should always allow demonstrations and dissent because they are an essential safety valve. And unless that safety valve is occasionally allowed to be released through dissent, then you get a powder keg that may eventually blow up.
No, I hear you. I certainly do. And I mean, we've got the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill 2021 that's just become a very, very controversial document. Measures that have been put into place. But why has it become so controversial so quickly, Salish?
I think part of the reason is that the Sarah Everard vigil, the aim of the Home Secretary was really to bring up to date legislation that controlled demonstrations and marches. Ordinarily, there's always some pushback from people like myself, from human rights lawyers, whenever a minister or government tries to limit any right, and particularly the right to protest. So there was bound to be some resistance, some negative comment. But the reason I think that it sparked such controversy is that at the time the bill was going through Parliament, we then had the Sarah Everard vigil and what looks like an overreaction by the police. And the reason that caught the public imagination is that the bill that was going through was designed to give the police far more powers
over protests, yeah, and basically measures that allow the police to take a more proactive and managing approach, so that protests that can cause serious disruption to the public can be prevented.
And what the public seem to have felt as a result of the media coverage is, if you give the police more powers in this particular area, if what you do is you give the police far more judgmental powers, it's a matter of judgment for the police as to whether a demonstration should occur, a matter of judgment what route it should take, a matter of judgment what level of policing and potentially what level of violence should be used to control demonstrators. And you saw that the judgment in relation to the Sarah Everard vigil may well have been exercised wrongly. Now, as soon as you start thinking as a member of the public, the police do sometimes get their judgment call wrong. And the more power you give someone to make that judgment call, the more likely it is that they're going to get it wrong and in a bad way. And that's why I think the public's imagination was caught by that. And the feeling was, do we really need to give the police, who can make mistakes, even more powers than they have?
But I totally hear you. I mean, you know, the part of the bill and the measures in the bill is that the matching existing police powers for protests, the same conditions on marches, to impose conditions such as the finish time and start times of the protests, maximum noise levels, and where noise can cause significant impact on those in the vicinity or serious disruption on the running of an organisation. But is it fair to say, you know, to come down so hard on the police when they get some things wrong? They don't get lots of things wrong, do they, Salish? I mean, I don't have statistics here on what, out of all the work that the police force has carried out, what percentage is incorrect. But I would say it's a very, very small percent. And when you're not there in that heat of that moment, and I'm not sort of particularly saying that the Sarah Everard vigil, where the lady's photographed that was taken, and the police have been accused of being very overhanded and having not handled the situation as best as they could, but generally, you know, the police can get things wrong because they're only human. I know they're doing a professional job. I know that they're trained, and I know that they shouldn't, but it could happen. I don't think it helped them in Sarah Everard's case, because they sort of turned around and said, well, we did nothing wrong. And there was lots of people saying that you have done something wrong. So that's obviously two sides of an argument. But if you're not there at the heat of the moment and you are the police trying to contain an environment, a situation that's, you know, where people are feeling, you know, very, very emotionally charged normally, it's a difficult job, right? I mean, it is a tough job for them too.
It is a very difficult and thankless task, being a police officer. And I agree with you that by and large, the police get their decision making right. And so during the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, by and large, I think the police and decisions were broadly correct. There were one or two areas. And it's very easy for those on the sidelines to point a finger as soon as one police officer does something slightly wrong or overreacts. No, the point isn't that, because, of course, the police have a very difficult job. The real philosophical concern is, if you give someone powers, eventually they're going to be misused, however decent and however nice they are. And so the first aspect of giving the police powers is you've got to make sure they're controllable, and that the powers is exercised in a transparent way so that others can see how they're exercised. But the more powers you give to people, however decent they are as human beings, because we are all human and we're all prone to err occasionally, those powers will either on purpose or accidentally be misused. And so what critics like me say, and human rights lawyers say, is be very careful in giving more powers to anyone, whether it's a politician or a police officer, and be very careful of giving huge powers because they can be misused.
I hear you. Again, I do hear you. I mean, you know, then you, there's the other side of the argument where people say, well, if the police don't have the powers to control numbers as they're growing and as maybe protests are growing or marches are growing, then how do we contain and control any situation that turns violent or that turns disruptive, you know, to other...
That's a very fair point.
Yeah.
But of course, the corollary of that is, do the police have enough powers? Because it's axiomatic that if the police don't have enough powers, then of course one should consider giving them the appropriate level of power and authority to control marches for the good of everyone. And so do they have enough powers? Well, they've got a wide range of powers at the moment, even if the bill does not go through Parliament. So, of course, the usual criminal law powers of arrest, if someone is causing damage to property, to statutes, people can be arrested. If they're behaving in a threatening way, they can be arrested.
Which they should be, you know, which they should be. I think, you know, I can totally appreciate that you could go to a protest or attend at a march and you could be really upset because what the point you're trying to make by being a bigger voice, part of a bigger group, could be a very, very sensitive one. But people can quickly become agitated. Again, I struggle with why will people become agitated? But I hear what you're saying. You know, if you've been through something that's so touchy, such a nerve, and you're going to say, look, I really want to prove this point. You know, sometimes emotions, we're all human, can take over. Same goes for the police. You know, they're professionals trying to do a professional job in a trained position. But I hear what you're saying, because they have the powers, it can very quickly be a situation of what they're doing is not wrong, but what the protests are doing quickly becomes wrong.
I think a good test that one could apply to most demonstrations and most legislation is transport yourself back to the days when women did not have the right to vote.
Yes, that was not that long ago, Salish. It really wasn't in some countries.
Exactly. And so I, in fact, live very near an Emily Pankhurst statue and memorial. And Emily Pankhurst and a number of other leaders of the suffragette movement, of course, they had to take certain action. They had to demonstrate because they were not ever going to be given the right to vote unless they brought it into the public consciousness. They had to take action, such as handcuffing themselves, tying themselves to railings. And of course, then the police reacted to what they were doing. But remember, Hattie, that the media at that time and the vast majority of people who were in power were against the suffragette movement. They were castigated. Anyone that was related to a suffragette was vilified by their neighbours and by their peers and by their bosses. And so there was a general feeling against the movement. And so this was a minority of women who had the audacity to demand a change for equality. And of course, we now look at that history from our own prism, and we see that it was the right thing to do. Whereas at that time...
But that's hindsight, isn't it, Salish?
Yes.
I mean, we look back and we say that was the right thing for them to do. And thank God they did. You know, as a woman, I'd say that. As a human being, I'll say that. But it's easy for us...
Hindsight, you see, because if we don't exercise hindsight and if we don't make ourselves aware that our present view could be wrong,
very
if we
true.
Were transported to the time of the suffragette movement, we might have been forgiven for saying the police were right to go in hard. This was a mad protest. How dare women ask for the vote? And you would have been in the majority if you thought that the police should force feed these protesters, should arrest them all, their horses should trample on them, etc. Now, of course, we'd say that would be an abhorrent view. And so all I'm suggesting is that we should stand back before coming to judgment about any particular demonstrations. And the true test should be, are they non-violent and are they within the broad right to protest as a group? And usually the answer is yes to those two questions.
I mean, I say this as a layperson, when, you know, you flick on the news and you see that there's a protest and they say that's turned violent, and the media will always put their spin on it as they see fit, of course. And you see the violence going on, you tend to think the way it's sold in the media is always, what are those people doing? Like, why would you go and cause trouble? Why would you go there and cause trouble for the police? You kind of tend to have that thought process as a layperson that's potentially not, you know, not part of that process. Why would you cause trouble for that area, for the people living there, for passers-by? Why would you do that? You tend to have that feeling and view. But with certainly with the Sarah Everard vigil, I didn't feel that those people were causing trouble at all. I just thought, come on, you know, why are you... I appreciate, and from my understanding, a part of the police's actions was due to COVID rules and regulations, saying, look, we're under lockdown, you're not allowed to gather, and we need to split you up and separate what's going on. And I know that COVID and lockdowns in across the world has caused great issues for protesting and for marches, because, you know, because of the whole, the laws that have come into COVID with self-isolating and not being able to socialise. Well, but how that, do...
That's one of the caveats to our Article 10 and Article 11 rights, our right to hold views and to demonstrate, because, of course, those aren't rights without limits. And so one of the limits is, of course, the public health perspective. So COVID regulations were brought in to protect the public from the spread of COVID. And of course, as a result, all demonstrations during lockdown have been banned. And so every Black Lives Matter protest was in breach of COVID regulations, just as the Sarah Everard protests were. Then the question arises, even though the demonstrators are breaching COVID rules, should the police turn a blind eye to those protests on the
basis...
But
how can they? Because the law says you are not allowed to protest right now. People are feeling passionate about something that's happened, understandably, and they want to protest. So what happens there? What's the right thing to happen there?
That's where the judgment call of the Home Secretary and Cressida Dick in London, any chief constable, that's where the police have to exercise judgment. Because on the one hand, it is a breach of the law. So in Sarah Everard's vigil, it was a breach of the law for those ladies to get together. However, there was the other right, the competing right, of their right to protest about the treatment of themselves as well as that young lady, the right of a woman to be safe. And then it becomes a judgment call. Of course, they could have been arrested, but the right decision was not to arrest them. And the public felt that as well. Hence, the public outcry when the police did try to arrest the vigil and try to stop it. But on the other hand, when the Black Lives Matter marches took place, most of them were allowed. There were only arrests made when there was some violence. Again, they could have been stopped right at the inception, but the police decided that sometimes the pressure valve that I keep talking about needs a release, and therefore it was right to allow a breach of the regulations and allow the demonstration in those circumstances.
I mean, it does feel, you know, extraordinary to even hear that, but that is exactly how it is. You know, just an exception was made, you know, by the police, and you don't hear that often when it comes to breaking the law, because I get it. Obviously, if we were not under COVID and not under lockdown restrictions, we'd like to think that breaking up the Sarah Everard vigil would have never even taken place, and those issues never would have arisen. But it's such a fine balance, isn't it? And what we're saying is the police are there trying to manage the law, and they're the ones that have the power to make the decision.
Can I give you a short quote about that?
Yes, please do. I'd love to hear a quote, because we're going to wrap up in a moment, but I would love to hear a quote, Salish.
From one of my favourite people, Frederick Douglass, who was a campaigner against segregation and slavery in America. And it's a quote that talks about why there is a need to demonstrate and why people do. And it goes as follows. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you will have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress.
Wow.
And those words are particularly pertinent in non-democratic countries. So when you think of the demonstrations in Russia going on, in favour of the man who's been imprisoned, Navalny. When you look at the Tiananmen Square demonstrations. And you'll remember that famous image of the man standing in front of a tank. And of course, there were thousands of arrests and many people died. Now, that quote from Frederick Douglass explains why people tolerate, and then if the government, the oppressor, presses any more, then eventually it's the right of the person to demonstrate and to say no more.
Wow, Salish. What a great podcast. Honestly, time just flies when I record with you, because they are the longest podcasts that we record, but time just flies. It's almost as if I love to hear your soothing voice just talking at me. And, you know, it's great. And the content has been great of this podcast, because I think that, you know, protesters' rights obviously are there, and clearly they should remain. And it's such an obviously they should remain, and it's such an important and sensitive topic actually to lots and lots of people. And I know you deal with lots of cases, both on a pro bono and on, you know, on a paid basis, obviously in representing protesters and in lots of difficult situations. So thank you so much for being a part of this podcast today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I look forward to part two. There you go. I've held you to it now. What I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube and Twitter. I think I said Twitter already, but I'll say it again, by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.